Well, it's why are we here time again. We always tend to look at it on this holy day, but this holy day, the Apostle John writing said, on that great day of the feast, not the last day of the feast, that great day of the feast. This is something that's really stupendous. And yet, if you just look at Scripture, unless you understand God's plan, what conception of this day can you possibly have? Nothing. Nothing. Because unless you understand God's plan, and you have God's Holy Spirit, and you can decipher this book, which, as it said, it's written here a little, there a little, line upon line, precept upon precept. Mr. Armstrong said it's a coded book. And as we'll see, we have these backward prophecies written just, why? So that people cannot understand. It's the same with the parables. I've heard so many times, you hear these programs, you hear these people talking, oh, Jesus spoke in parables so we would all understand. It just goes to show that they haven't read the Bible. Christ quite clearly stated that he spoke in parables so they wouldn't understand, because that's not part of his plan. His plan started with Adam, and it's going to end when those tares are thrown into that burning cauldron and the whole earth is reformed and that holy city comes down. That plan encompasses that whole 7,000 years. Mr. Armstrong, writing in Pagan Holidays or God's Holy Days, which he says, yet another festival. Did you notice that the Feast of Tabernacles is only the sixth festival? There is yet another, the seventh. The Feast of Tabernacles is, strictly speaking, 7 days long to picture the entire millennium. Seven is God's number of completeness. Therefore, there must also be seven festivals. Let us notice where it is mentioned. The 15th day of this seventh month shall be a feast of tabernacles for 7 days unto the eternal. That's what's in Leviticus 23:34, which we all know, don't we? On the eighth day shall be a holy convocation unto you. It is a day of solemn assembly. You will do no servile work therein. It doesn't tell you anything about why. It's just the eighth day. This eighth day technically is a separate feast. It's called the last day. And in John 7:37, the last great day of the feast. So it's obvious that this day is more than special. It's great. Notice what Jesus preached about this day. If any man thirsts, this is John 7:37. If any man thirsts, let him come to me and drink out of his belly, his innermost being, Mr. Armstrong wrote, shall flow rivers of living waters. But thus he spoke of the Spirit, which they that believe on him should receive. But the only people that can receive that Spirit are the ones that God personally has handpicked. Because the plan goes all through the 7,000 years. Everybody has their chance at getting into the God family in their particular time. And nobody can jump the gun. Because if you don't have the Holy Spirit, you can't understand what this book's talking about. Mr. Armstrong says, this was Jesus' sermon giving the meaning of the last great day. He says, now turn to Revelation 20. After the millennium, what happens? A resurrection. The dead stand before God. This couldn't include true Christians today, as they will appear before the judgment seat when Christ returns. That's us. It couldn't refer to those converted during the millennium. They have already inherited the kingdom during the millennium after living out a normal lifespan. Those in this resurrection must be those who died in ignorance in past ages. They are not brought to life until after the millennium. And he makes a note there, Revelation 20, verse 5. So I think it's appropriate that what we should do is have a quick look at the whole plan. You know, we've got here something that is so special. It is so awesome. And we all kind of think we know it backwards. And yet, if you think about it, this is the most important piece of information we have. You know, if you think about it, you get a pilot getting into his new Boeing Dreamliner. And as long as the batteries don't blow up and fill the cabin with smoke, he takes off. He's in a plane that's worth, I don't know, $100 million maybe? Something ridiculous like that. It's been put together by thousands of people over months. He has tremendously powerful engines. But if he hasn't got a map, he doesn't know where he's going. And Mr. Armstrong using an example one day about having a goal, and he said, you can just imagine the plane takes off and it goes round and up and round and up and round and up, and the captain comes on and he says, well, good morning, everybody. We are now flying at our operational level of 36,000 feet. Where shall we go? And people are sitting there thinking, well, I bought a ticket to Tokyo. What's he talking about? Where should we go? You've got to have a plan. The world doesn't understand this. The world cannot understand this. And yet when we go through these holy days, it becomes very obvious. And the culmination of that plan is what we're doing here today, what we're celebrating here today. Mr. Armstrong, on a sermon in 1985, April 6th, that was only 10 months before he died, the first day of unleavened bread, he said, I wonder if we really do realize fully and comprehend the real meaning of the festival. And he's talking here about unleavened bread. He says, I first learned back very early in the year 1927. Now, there are a couple of people who were here today who are running around then, but not very many. That we should keep the Passover and that we should keep seven special Sabbath days, annual Sabbaths or holy days. At the time, I didn't know why. That's 1927. I think most of you have never heard the history of how I came to keep the Sabbath, how I found out about these days. And in a sense, that's how you came to be here today. I wish everybody in God's church could get this point. Because if you're keeping this day today, the only way you found out about it was through God's servant. Nobody else. Nobody else. And in a sense, that's how you came to be here today, how you came to be keeping these days, because God brought it in to me. He revealed it to him. And he took his time, didn't he? 7 years, as we'll see. 7 years he kept it, and he had no clue what he was doing. And I don't know of any church that's kept these days for hundreds and hundreds of years. I saw, however, that they were ordained forever. I saw that Jesus Christ had kept these days and set as an example that we should do the same thing. The foundation. Back to the foundation. I saw the disciples kept these days. And when they became apostles, they taught the church. And the early church kept these festivals. I saw that they were ordained forever. They were kept in the New Testament as well as the Old. I didn't know why. I didn't say, well, why? Well, why, Lord? I won't do it unless you show me why. I just said, God says, do it, and I'll do it. Just like Abraham, God said, go. Abraham, who was a multi-billionaire, probably lived in a great mansion, had lots and lots of servants. And he said, go. And Abraham packed everything up, got himself a tent, and off he went. He lived in a tent. Now, it was probably a very elaborate tent. But he didn't quibble. He just went. And then when the church, the first church was raised up in that became the parent church in this Philadelphia era in Eugene, which means good birth, incidentally. Oregon, in the county schoolhouse. That was in the autumn of 1933. 11 years later, I was born. That feels like a long time ago right now. I began to teach these days. That autumn, we kept the fall annual Sabbaths, and the next spring, we kept not only the Passover and the foot washing, but also the holy days, and we didn't know why. And this was 1933 now, and he still didn't know why. But now he had a group. I believe that group was 19 people. And they kept them another 7 years. So it was 1940, by the looks of things, right about 1940, after being called in 1927, that he finally got to understand the meaning of these days. Now, for those interested in numbers, you know, God's numbers are stamped all over these feast days in the most unique way. The number seven is regarded as the great number of spiritual perfection of 7 days in the week and so on. Nowhere is this more obvious than in God's plan. The feast contain seven holy days, right? Two in unleavened bread and one in each of the other feast days, of which we are now celebrating the seventh. Passover is not a holy day, and yet it is referred to as a feast. So, there are seven holy days. There are seven events. Because if you take, forget the fact there are two holy days in unleavened bread, to take unleavened bread as being a feast, and you take the Passover in, you still have seven events. And in those, within those seven events, the Passover is not a holy day, but there are two in unleavened bread. So you still have seven. Now, we understand that the Feast of Tabernacles and the Last Great Day are actually two separate feasts, right? Tabernacles finished yesterday. I did warn you, it wouldn't last long. It's the shortest 7 days. It's the shortest 7 days on the planet in the year. It goes back very, very quickly. Now, we tend to refer to that, the 8 days, as the feast, don't we? This is, to us, this is the last, well, it's the great day of the feast. And John actually said that. It's the great day of the feast. Right? But now we have 8 days. So where does that lead us? Well, just as 666 is Satan's number, and 888 is the number of Christ. The number 8, and here again, it ties in so beautifully with today, the 8th day of the feast, the number 8 is the number of superabundance. And isn't that what's going to happen on this day? It's been variously estimated. It's very difficult. We were talking about this last night. How many people are going to be there? Now, it's very difficult to work that out, because we've got today a population of somewhere around about 7 billion. We just passed the 7 billion mark a few weeks back, evidently. Now, it says, as it was in the days of Noah. So we can assume that back then, just before the flood, that the population of the world might have been round about the same. So there's a lot of people that lived before the flood. There's been people living all the way through the years. But keeping one thing, again, we must watch out for this evil ocean, as Mr. Armstrong used to call it. It's in all our minds, and that is that everything starts here, and it slowly, over hundreds of millions of years, grows. And we have those poor old dinosaurs jumping out of trees and shredding their scales, and eventually, after 572 million years precisely, one of them managed to glide a meter before it died. And eventually, we saw on the thing, they became birds. Like 6,000 different varieties, some of them so tiny they're like a bumblebee, and some of them so big they could hitch a lift on them virtually. But they all came from those dinosaurs who jumped out of trees. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. But how many people have ever lived? Well, you see, the problem we've got is we don't understand what's happened in history. You see, the evolutionist concept of uniformitarianism, which is not a big long word, means everything stays the same. And no, it doesn't. Catastrophe is what comes. All the way through, we have catastrophe. The flood was a catastrophe. I know Dr. Hayes speculated that before the flood, the world was basically one large continent. And that during the flood, the whole thing was ripped apart. I mean, look at a map. You can see how India has been thrust up into China, rising up the Himalayas. And you can look around the world. You can take on a computer. I've seen it done on the computer now. They take all the nations and they bring them all together. And they all fit. So it seems pretty obvious that at one stage they were all one. Is that going to happen at the end? Well, we have some tremendous earthquakes. And the islands are not found. And the mountains have all gone. So it does make one wonder, are we going to go back to one continent? Are people even going to live 1,000 years, restoration of all things? It does make you wonder, as we'll see through here, I'll show you where that speculation actually comes from. So there you go, we've got this seven and seven and seven, and we've got eight. And eight is the one who controls the plan where the sevens are, and that's Christ. So even numerically, the feast is perfect. It could have been 10 days. Why not 10 days? Because it's all to do with law, isn't it? Or why not 12 days? It's all to do with government. But no, it's 7 days. And it ties in with the 7 days and the 7 weeks. They clean up the bodies. Remember, they clean up the bodies? 7 years. 7 months, sorry. They can't touch a tree for 7 years. It's all in... Why? Because these numbers mean something. So let's start off with the Passover. If you turn to Exodus 12, verse 1. And the Eternal spoke unto Moses and Aaron in the land of Egypt, saying, this month shall be unto you the beginning of months. Now then, during the Exodus, there was a question came up. Were the months altered? Were the seasons altered? You see, was the Exodus just a quiet little, we go there and the sea opens up and through they go and the sea closes and the Egyptians all die and then they walk off into the wilderness? That, in some claim, was also a time of great catastrophe. And what I was trying to get across earlier was, we had that catastrophe. You had a catastrophe at the sea. All the men, all the strong men of Egypt died. Egypt just collapsed as a society. If you go through even European history, this whole nation's just disappeared. They just found a city at the bottom of the sea off the coast of North Africa, and there's gold coins and things lying in the street. In other words, either the sea rose very quickly up or the land went very quickly down. And both can happen. We've just had an earthquake in Pakistan. About 380, I believe, is the latest death toll. 300,000 people have lost their homes. And then they came out there, what was left of their homes yesterday morning, and found that 1 kilometer off the shore, there was a great big island come up. 200 meters by 100 meters. And just come right up 70 feet out the sea. So, you know, these things can happen. It's very difficult to estimate how many people we're going to be dealing with on this day, because it's very difficult. We don't know all the catastrophes. What happened to the Aztecs? What happened to the Incas? They were either slaughtered or they just disappeared. We've got evidence of all around the world of great societies who did things that we could never dream of doing. And they just gone, disappeared. Either wiped out in war or a catastrophe, earthquakes, who knows? It's very, very difficult. The best estimate we're looking at, I would imagine, was somewhere between 70 and 100 billion people. Now, we have 7 billion people on the planet today. But when you look at the fact that most of the Earth is totally uninhabitable, and you look at the fact that in the millennium there's a lot of evidence that points to the fact there'll be a lot more land space, the Earth could well support that. Especially if the weather system is benign and these people are resurrected, as they will be, into, as we've seen just now, into a landscape that is the Garden of Eden. And here we are now in the beginning of months, and you take the blood. Well, we know the story. Let's take the blood of the Lamb, and they had to paint the posts, and the death angel passed over them. And again, they should have got the point. If you are under that blood, you are in a special category, right? You are in a special category. Let's just do it again for fun. How many people here are firstborn? Put your hands up. It's quite a few. If you think about it, all of you had died if you hadn't had blood over the door. We did this once at Brickett Wood among the students, and it was actually amazing. There was over half the student body were firstborn. And if you think about it, it is not just you. In those days, families would live together. And you'd have probably granddad and grandma. You might even have the odd uncle or aunt living within the greater family, and mum and dad and kids and all the rest of it. It's quite conceivable that most of them could have been wiped out. If mum and dad were firstborn, and their mum and dad were firstborn, and the eldest child was obviously firstborn, they'd all die. Just the younger ones were left. You could see the devastation that took place in Egypt when this happened, this event happened. Amazing. Absolutely amazing. But did the Israelites get the point? Did the Israelites get the point? They were special. They couldn't get it. And the reason they couldn't get it is verse 11. It talks about, and thus shall you eat it with your loins girded and your shoes on your feet and your staff in your hand, and you shall eat it in haste. It is the Lord's Passover. But they couldn't get it. Incidentally, it wasn't the Jewish Passover. There was still a long time to go before the Jew walked on the earth, really. So, these are God's feast day. And God said, when you see the blood, I will pass over you, and the plague shall not be on you, verse 13, to destroy you, and I smite the land of Egypt. You see, here God's saying, I'm going to do it. I'm going to smite this land. I'm going to destroy everybody, the firstborn of everybody, including the beasts as well, where there's no blood on those posts. All right, it was a physical thing they had to do. They had to get that, and you bet they did it. They did it, because they feared. And once it happened, then they feared a bit more. And then they were led out of Egypt. Oh, we'll come into that right now. It comes to the days of unleavened bread. There are two holy days. Interesting, why two holy days? Well, on the first holy day, they were led out of Egypt. Right? It says 7 days, this is Exodus 12, verse 15. But before we go into that, there's one point I want to make here, because this is the key to understanding this day. This is the key to understanding this day. The 7 days of unleavened bread pictures the church coming out of sin, out of Egypt, and then entering the promised land and living God's way. You can't do it without the Spirit of God. It is totally impossible. It's totally impossible. My mom was around the church for years and years and years. And she helped all sorts of people. She'd sew for some people. She'd cook food for some of the older ladies. Did all sorts of things for them. And yet when you come to this side of it, the spiritual side of it, over the top of the head, never got it. And the problem is, without the Holy Spirit, you can take the Israelite out of Egypt, but you can't take Egypt out of the Israelite. That's the key. And today, don't we have the same thing today? You still have people today who are in the same position. Look at the gods we have today. Yeah. They got to the stage now where you can't criticize anybody for doing anything, otherwise you might hurt their little itsy bitsy feelings. It's just total madness. 7 days so you keep unleavened bread. And it goes on down. He says, verse 17, for on this selfsame day I brought your armies out of the land of Egypt. Why does he call them armies? Well, what was Moses? Moses was a general. He had them march in ranks of five. It must have been an absolutely splendid sight. Because to get out as quickly as they did, it must have been in ranks of five this way, but it must have also gone pretty wide. They must have just walked out covering the whole desert. It must have stunned the Egyptians. It certainly stung them into action, didn't it? And then we have the second holy day. Now the second holy day is the day when Jericho was destroyed. Jericho was compare Jericho? In those days, Jericho was it. It was the totally defendable city. There was no way anybody was ever going to take Jericho. The walls were so wide you could drive a chariot around them. You're up on a big wall like that when the enemy's got bows and arrows at best. It's impregnable. Had its own water supply. They had plenty of food. They could last a siege for years. And then we have this thing where God tells them, right, you get all the people and you march around the wall, around the walls, once every day, in utter, total silence. Now that must have been just out of the range of arrows, I'd imagine. And 6 days they did that. On the seventh day, they had to go around seven times. And the priests at the head of this, going around. And at the command, they had to shout. And at that shout, the walls came down. All except one little section. And you know, we went down there when I was in Israel, and there is a small mound, one section of that wall, still there. It was still there. That's where Rahab was. Why? Because God said he'd protect her. See, God can do anything that he wants. Total control. One person and her household were saved. Everybody else was slaughtered. So you have those two holy days. One was coming out of Egypt, coming out of sin, and the second one was supposed to be going into the promised land and living God's way. And this is a small thing that just came to mind. It was prepared for them, wasn't it? They went into the land prepared. There was harvests, there was food, there was fruit, there was everything. Everything was ready for them. There was stuff already there for them, houses. It was all ready for them. They just walked in and just took the countryside over. God even said he'd drive out the enemy with hornets. I mean, you've only got to watch Mr. Bowles and a wasp comes in here. I tell you this, he might be tired, but I saw him move yesterday so quick. It sounds funny, but wasp stings are not nice if you've got a problem with being allergic to them. One wasp sting can actually kill some people. So how do you think it's been stung by a hornet? I was stung by a hornet. Down in Rhodesia, I had this. I did the for a stupid bet. somebody bet me I couldn't knock a hornet's nest out of a tree at 200 yards with a rifle. And since I had my marksman's badge, I was fairly accurate. And guess what? I did. And it fell out of the tree onto a rock. And up came a couple of hundred very, very, very cheesed off hornets. They did not take to this very kindly. And they buzzed around and buzzed around. And we could see them coming towards us. So we ran for the river. And we dived into the river. And as I hit the water, I felt something hit me in the face. I got stung just under the eye here. Eventually, we made it back. And we got the rifle. And we staggered back the 2 miles to the doctor. I was being led between two of the guys. I couldn't see. My face had blown up like a football. Yeah, one hornet. One very angry hornet. Mind you, these hornets, by the way, they're, maybe in America you might have something like this, but they are a good 2 inches long. They're not for playing with. We were doing the car one day down there, and one came into the garage. Philip will remember this. And the only thing I could do, we had this carburetor cleaner. You know that stuff you used to spray on the carburetor, and all the muck used to just come off it. It was there, shiny. It's so brilliant. Now they're finding out that it's carcinogenic and it causes arthritis and all the other nice things that we all end up with when we get to my age. But never mind. I just picked this up and hit this thing in midair, and it just fell out of the sky like this. Woo, dead. And we had a look at it, and I mean, it was a good 2 inches long. And the bit sticking out the back was a quarter of an inch long. You just don't want to get stung with that. Now, God used those hornets to drive the people out. The Israelites didn't have to fight. They just couldn't get it right. They couldn't get it right, and they never got it right, have they, to this day? You go out and mention God to anybody today, and chances are you get laughter. Then we come to Pentecost. In the booklet, it says, the day of Pentecost, originally called the Feast of First Fruits, pictures the church as the first to be begotten and born as children of God during the church age. We are almost there. We are almost there. I hope on the Sabbath to go through some of the things that are going on in the world today, and you will see that it's at the door. It may be a year, it may be 2 years, it may be 3 years, but it's very, very close. This might be, again, the last feast we keep together under these circumstances. Could very well be. Could very well be. So we have the first fruits, repenting, being baptized, and receiving the Holy Spirit, thus making it possible to start down the road thinking like God thinks. And remember, God hasn't called a church. He's not called us to be in a church, really. He's called us out to a teacher's training college. In a sense, the millennium is the church. That's when we get to do our job. That's when we get to become teachers, as we've been going through the whole week. Just turn to Acts 2. And when the day of Pentecost was fully come, they were all with one accord in one place. Hold on a minute. Who was there? Who was there? The 12 apostles. And another few bunch of people. There was 120 people. It says, they were all with one accord in one place. 120 of them. Oh, hold on a minute. What happened after this? Peter gets up and preaches a sermon. A sermon that Stephen repeated not long after, and it cost him his life. And yet Peter gets up and gives that sermon, and they start queuing up at the Jordan River. Because they were stunned. What have we done? They realized they'd actually killed the Messiah. Why? Because God opened the mind. He took the Egyptian out of the Israelite. Suddenly they saw. They opened. The mind was opened. And they saw what they'd done. And they repented. And they got baptized. And suddenly the 12 apostles had a bunch of people to teach. And how many did they have? Well, if you look at the figures and you read through the book of Acts, it seems that the church was probably 10, 15,000 people very quickly. If you think there were 12, well, there were 120 would probably be teachers. It's a lot of people to teach. They had to set up a whole church from scratch. And this is what we'll be doing in the millennium. When these people come through, we'll be starting from scratch. The only thing is, we'll be getting people just like the apostles were given then. We'll be getting people who have come through hell and worse. The worst time of trouble ever, never to be repeated, right? They will be injured. They will be lame. They will be blind. They will be deaf. They will be dumb. They'll be healed. And they'll be put into villages. And they'll be taught God's way. But they'll want to learn. The rebels have all been weeded out. And this is the exciting part. This is what the apostles ended up with on the day of Pentecost. They got people who wanted to learn because they realized that they'd really messed up big time. And like I said the other day, you know, when they come into the land, the first thing they've got to do is get rid of every last vestige of Satan's world before we can actually get into the actual millennium. Can you imagine what it must have been like? How would you feel being, if this was a room, and suddenly, with all the doors and the windows closed, because it wasn't a kind of popular time to be following Christ, if you remember, since they just murdered him and gone around, wanting to destroy the church. So they were, I guess they were kind of fearful in that sense. They were probably locked away in this building, and suddenly the wind started blowing from like where? And flames of fire appeared on their head. You've got to try and think of it. What these, there's a rushing, mighty wind. Bang goes your hair, ladies. And there appeared cloven tongues like as to fire, and it sat on each of them. And they were filled with the Holy Spirit and began to speak to each other in tongues as the Spirit gave them utterance. Now, if you look, this always, is one of these scriptures that is so abused, particularly by people in the Pentecostal persuasion. And I have actually seen one or two lying on the floor, foaming at the mouth, and uttering complete gibberish. And this is speaking in tongues. Like, what does that achieve? But you see, the trouble was, if you check 2 verse 8, it said, "And how hear we every man in his own tongue?" You see, they weren't so much speaking in tongues. The others were hearing in ears. But hearing in ears doesn't sound good, does it? It's a bit like cigarette smoking. The taste of Peter Stuyvesant or whatever. You don't taste smoke, you smell it. The smell of a player's cigarette doesn't sound too good, does it? Because those who don't smoke know that people that smoke a cigarette stinks, particularly when it's stale. You walk into a room. I know we used to go to the feast at these holiday camps, like in the Bufflin's holiday camps and so on. And the first time we walked into the hall, there was this horrendous stench from all the cigarette smoke. And everything you touched had to be cleaned because it was just horrendous. So it's all about hearing with ears. Will we come back to this? You see, the language question is not a problem because at Babel, God showed us what happens. He confused the language to stop man going too far too quick. Because they all spoke one language. And he says, this they begin to do, nothing will be withheld from them. You know, we're now talking about downloading people's brains into a computer as a means of immortality. This is being seriously suggested. They're working on it. And it gets worse. This is the way mankind is going. And that way is Satan's way. And it would lead to 1984 and all the other stories that the science fiction Jeffy's got, where people would be totally controlled. Even today, our mind is controlled. You don't think about it. And it's not so bad in England. Well, it's getting as bad. But in America, when I was over there years ago, when the college was, when I was still working at the college, you put the television on, and I forget the guy's name was Sims. There you go. See, it stuck with me. This is going back now to 1971. I went to an editorial conference, and it was a guy called Jay Sims, I think it was. And he was in downtown Pasadena, and he sold all the latest automobiles. And you're all going to come down here and see what I've got. I've got the best deals in town. And you got this every 7 minutes during the news. And of course, what was the news all about? Well, the world was falling apart the other day. There was all sorts of dramas going on. There were people dying and people being gassed. And what was the lead headline on the BBC? "You're all going to pay 5p for a plastic bag next year or the year after." You despair. Here we are at the end of the age. We're watching out for all these things. And what the BBC offers us is that we're going to be paying 5p for a plastic bag as the lead story. Forget that there's a war in Syria. Well, you just go on and on and on, can't you? Are they worried about plastic bags? We then go down to the Feast of Trumpets. On the first day of the seventh month, the Feast of Trumpets pictures the second coming of Christ to take over Earth's throne and to rule all nations.
Ooh, we don't like that, do we?
We do. We very much do. But the world doesn't. But it's more than just the return of Christ. On the lead up to his return, the whole world, Satan's world, is totally destroyed. This is Mr. Armstrong writing in the booklet, not me. The whole world, this whole world, Satan's world, is totally destroyed. As we saw in the Sermon on the Trees, right? Germany, there'll be a little child who can sit and do a head count of the trees. Now, I've driven through Germany, and you can drive for an hour or two in some places, and you're just going through forest. They've got thousands of square miles of forest. And there'll be enough trees left for a child to count on his hands. That kind of light goes as far as 10, as far as I go. Not very many trees left. Total devastation. Everything's got to be wiped. What do we do with Fukushima? At the moment, there are three reactors, I believe, that are totally out of control, and they are burning down and down and down and down and down into the earth. They could explode at any minute, evidently. They're getting 300 tons every day of foul water, water that is dangerous, that they've used to cool this lot, and they've built huge tanks, three stories high, hundreds and hundreds of them. You see the photograph from the air, there's row upon row upon row of these tanks, all full of water, radioactive water, highly dangerous water. Nobody's even asking the question, what are we going to do with all this stuff? What can you do? The tanks were built, by the way, quickly, with a shelf life of about 3 years. They're already leaking. The water's already leaking into the ground. If that water gets into the down into the aquifers, and that's where Tokyo gets its water, the whole of Tokyo might have to be evacuated. 36 million people. That's how bad it is. It could actually destroy the whole land of Japan. I do wonder, because Javan is not mentioned much in the end time prophecies. You don't come across the name even. So, are we going to see a real dramatic problem in Japan? It could well be. It could well be. The whole world, all of Satan's world is destroyed. It's not just Christ coming. His coming finalizes this. Because we can't start the world tomorrow with bits and pieces of this world. Oh, this nuclear power station here, we could just patch this up and we could get that running for a while. No, no. We don't want that. We don't want any of that stuff. It's all got to go. That's what it says. Then we come to the Day of Atonement. On the 10th day of the seventh month, the Day of Atonement, which pictures the putting away of Satan for 1,000 years. I know Mr. Jackson referred to this as something I was talking to somebody about this week. Why the time gap between Christ coming back on the first day and the 10th day Satan gets put away? What is that period for? It might be one mammoth wedding feast. Is that a period where we get some training? I mean, do you not think we might just possibly need a little bit of training? Suddenly, you are a spirit being, and you have you're kind of powerful. You know, remember John said, it doesn't appear what we're going to be, but when he appears, we will be like him, because we'll see him as he is. Visualize yourself in this position. You are glowing. You're just seething with power. Right? Don't you think we might have to be taught a little bit as to how to use it? How to control ourselves? How do you then change back and look like a human being so that the teachers aren't hidden? They can see that they can talk to their teachers. We're going to have to learn a lot. Maybe that's it. We don't know. There's no indication that I've ever seen. I've never heard anybody give a proper explanation of it. But then we have Satan being removed. We can now turn to Isaiah 14. Because we can't have this day without this happening. And verse 12. How are you fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? How art thou cut down to the ground that did weaken the nations? For you have said into your heart, I will ascend into the heaven, I will exalt my throne above the stars of God. I also will sit upon the mount of the congregation in the sides of the north. I will ascend above the height of the clouds. I will be the Most High, basically. He wanted to form a coup. And what do we see all around the world today? Coups. There's always somebody taking over somebody else's government. We've got a thing in Syria at the moment under construction. But there are several others, I believe, going on at the same time. This is the ultimate coup attempt. Verse 16. Or verse 15. Yet you will be brought down to hell. You will be brought down to the ground, to the sides of the pit. This restraint that we heard about just now. And a prison from which he cannot possibly escape. And it says, they that see you shall narrowly look upon you and consider you, saying, is this the man that made the earth to tremble and did the kingdoms shake kingdoms? Interesting, the word there is man. It's almost like it's an insult, because we're all God. And we're going to look at this being. Is he still going to be looking beautiful? That's what he was. He was made, he was a sum total of beauty. But it's perverted. And suddenly, he's surrounded by all these sons of God. He's nothing. He wouldn't even qualify as a doorkeeper. Remember, David wanted that job. He said in one of the Psalms, I'll be happy to be a doorkeeper in the kingdom of God. That's humility for you. We'll look narrowly on him and say, is this the thing that caused all the problems? Shut the lid. Throw the chain around him and throw him down the pit. Because that's when life begins for the people in this world, when that being is locked away. Until then, there's not much of a chance. There's no chance. Then we come to the Feast of Tabernacles, which of course we've just enjoyed. The Feast of Tabernacles pictures the thousand-year reign under the rule of Christ and the born children of God. We'll turn to 1 Corinthians 15. Paul understood this one well. 1 Corinthians 15 and verse 50. Now this I say, brethren, that flesh and blood cannot inherit the kingdom of God, neither does corruption inherit incorruption. The only thing that can inherit the kingdom of God is perfect divine character. Behold, I show you a mystery. And this is it, you see. This is the key, and this is why the world can't understand this plan. It's a total mystery to them. And they cannot understand it because they don't have God's Spirit. We shall not all sleep, but we shall all be changed. Right, stop right there. We can't go on. Paul got it all wrong. So we've got to now totally discredit Paul, because he's got it wrong. He said, we shall be changed. No, he was wrong. He was 2,000 years. How big a mistake is that? He was 2,000 years out. So surely now we must discredit all of Paul's writings. I mean, people have used this kind of excuse because Mr. Armstrong might have speculated about something that didn't actually happen. They completely forget about the dozens upon dozens upon dozens of other things where he said, this is a possibility, that's a possibility, this could happen, we're going to see, possibly going to see this, and it's all happened all the way down through the years. And one thing I thought the other day, too, totally unrelated about Mr. Armstrong. After the war, he was actually at the founding member, the founding of the United Nations. How did he get in there? You don't just walk into those conferences. Let me tell you don't walk into those conferences. I've been to a lot of big conferences like that, and you checked out. They want to see your passport. They want to see your press pass. They want a telephone number they can ring to verify that you're you before you even get in the door. So how did he get in there? Because he was there because God wanted him there. Because that was a very, very, very important event. And he got to see all those people. I think at that time, he probably understood something I understood very quickly when I got into the news business. When you get around these world leaders, you know what you suddenly discover? They're not on a pedestal. They're just people. If they don't shower, they stink. If they drink too much, you can smell it a mile away. In other words, they're just human beings. They're just human beings. all of them. Because we do tend to look at these people and we put them on pedestals. And we've got to have the right attitude, because God does say that we should pray for them. And we shouldn't speak ill of them, because he's put them there. I mean, look at our country at the moment. Who's leading us? We've got three young fellas. They've still got little kids they take to kindergarten, right? So we could turn around and say they've never had a job, not a one of them. Three leaders that are out there at the moment. But you know what? God put them there. Why? He's put them there to bring this country to his knees. Just the same as he's put President Obama in control of America to destroy it. And you know, you've got to give him 9.5 out of 10. He's doing a jolly good job. He's turned America around in the last half a dozen years or so. That's a tremendous rate that God put in there to do that. That's why we should pray. We should pray that he gets it right quicker. And then we can end all this mess. Yes. He'll be bound for 1,000 years. We enter the Feast of Tabernacles. Oh, we're here, aren't we? Yes. And this corruptible must put on incorruption, and this mortal must put on immortality, so that when this corruptible shall have put on incorruption, and this mortal shall have put on immortality, then shall be the pastor saying that is written, death is swallowed up in victory. Oh, death, where is your sting? Oh, grave, where is your victory? You know, we know that when we die, if we die in this age, we're buried and we're waiting for the resurrection. It's still, though, we buried our granny just a couple of years ago, 2 years ago now, 1 year ago, 1 year ago. And we know her attitude was as solid and as straight as it can be. She had this thing about time, and we actually joked that we'd put a watch on with a new battery, and so that when the resurrection took place, she could make sure it was on time, because she was very fastidious about time. Breakfast had to be 8 o'clock, lunch had to be 1 o'clock, dinner had to be 6 o'clock, and there's no excuses for it not happening, like. But she was looking for the resurrection. Now she's dead. And as much as you know this, when you see that coffin going down into the ground, it's, isn't it? It's horrible. Death is something that's just vile. It's going. It's going to stop. It's going to stop. Revelation 20. Verse 6. Blessed and holy is he that has part in the first resurrection. On such the second death has no power. The second death is when all those who don't want it, frankly, they don't want it, won't accept it, they won't accept life in the God family, they get frazzled as Christ literally incinerates the whole world. He incinerates it to purify it and to remodel it. Because this holy city is coming down, and it's kind of big. And the whole world will be a place of extreme beauty. But they shall be priests of God and Christ, and shall reign with him 1,000 years. Now, that's what we've lived for. That's what we've just lived through, isn't it? But verse 5... But the rest of the dead live not again until the 1,000 years were finished. You see, there's a time and a place for every single person. All who've ever lived will come up in this resurrection on this day. We were in the first resurrection. The people who are in the millennium will have their chance in the millennium. And then we have this resurrection on this day. Because this day is, well, the whole work of the millennium is to prepare the world for this day. Because there's got to be, it's God's way. He takes us into the wilderness as a place of safety, to a place prepared for you. He brought the Israelites out of Egypt to a place prepared for them. Right? And during the millennium is the preparing for this resurrection. Well, what do you do with 70 billion people if there's no food, no clothes, no housing, and nobody to help them? When most of them probably died in battle or died in plagues, or earthquakes, or tsunamis, or whatever. I remember seeing there was a video made it onto the internet. It was actually withdrawn very quickly because it actually showed people dying. He saw a man climbing up the side of a house and just being crushed against another building at great speed. And he thought, that's his life snuffed out. He never knew. He never knew God. He never knew God's way. All he saw was he's clinging onto the side of his house, and he died. Others were driving along vainly in their cars as this water rushes in crazy speed. And you just see the cars getting tumbled over and over and over and over. Gone. Finished. Snuffed out. About 20,000 people, I believe, died. Quite incredible. But they're all coming back. Now, you know, you try and tell that to people in the world, and they look at you and say, oh, nice fella, bit dim, you know. Can't take it in. To say that everybody is coming back to physical life. So this means that after the 1,000 years are finished, the rest of the dead, from Adam right up to the second coming of Christ, will be resurrected to physical life, and they will have their chance to become immortal members of God's family. So think about it. Let's just say 70 billion. It's a nice round number. We've got 70 billion people. We've got people right from the beginning. We'll have Cain. We will have to face his brother Abel. Should be interesting. Hello, brother. Oh. How do you think Cain's going to feel? Remember, no Satan. No Satan. And God's Spirit's been poured out on Cain now. And Cain realizes what he's done. Do you think Cain's going to be teachable? All those men of the Old Testament, the only two, other two that seem to be righteous were Enoch. We don't know what Enoch did. We know he was a preacher of righteousness, and that because he preached righteousness, he died. It says translated, he died. He was martyred. But he saw Christ coming with 10,000s of his saints. He knew God's plan, or he knew a good part of it. He knew that Christ was coming at some stage. Was it a work? Were there ministry? We don't know. We're not told. Chances are there were some people there. There's got to be witnesses from every era. But from the flood era, from that era pre-flood, when everybody lived for, you know, getting on for 1,000 years, you only need a group from one area because they didn't know the whole story. Enoch taught everybody from Adam up to Methuselah, with one exception. He died, and 80 years later, Noah was born. So God had to reveal the truth to Noah again. Because after 80 years, you can bet your bottom dollar there wasn't much truth about. It only took 15 years after Christ was killed, where Paul goes to the Galatians and say, what's going on here? You're off track. How come? 15 years after Christ himself was on the ground. So after 80 years, you can bet that God had to teach Noah. And you come then, all those people who died in the flood, all those people who were banged. Remember, you know, God said to Noah, I've got to be careful there because I told one or two about, I was giving a table topic session at college in one of the speech clubs, and I was trying to get across that the theme I had was to make people listen. And I said, right, we'll start off with a Bible topic. I want you to listen very, very carefully. How many pairs of unclean animals did Moses take into the ark with him? Mr. Sanso. And the guy gets up and down, anybody else? And Mr. Dart, who was our coordinator, was sitting there guffawing into his hand. Because I said, Moses, I didn't say Noah, but I placed the emphasis on unclean animals. And I made a big thing about unclean animals, right? Get that? Unclean animals. Did Moses take him to the ark with him? That's what they heard. They heard unclean animals, right? So you listen to the news today, and what do you get? In 2015, you'd be paying 5p for a plastic bag. Meanwhile, the earth is falling apart in front of people, and they're not being warned. They're not being told. It's the same kind of thing. The attention's not there. The attention is thrown sideways. But it's all been done for a reason, because God puts everybody in a place, and this is the day when virtually everybody who's ever lived will be resurrected. Or the millennium, obviously, will be a separate entity. But up until the return of Christ, all those people are going to be resurrected. What about all those Jews that died? Somebody once, I was actually a Jewish guy, he said, well, he says, if it's going to be 100 years, I reckon we got to get Adolf Hitler and we got to get him cleaning Jewish toilets for 50 years. Then we might forgive him. How would you like to hear a conversation between Adolf Hitler, Mussolini, Churchill, Genghis Khan, what was his name? Nebuchadnezzar. Yeah, Nebuchadnezzar and so on. How would you like all these guys around the table discussing military tactics? And you can say, yeah, you were all very clever, weren't you? Do you know what? You're all messed up. You're all messed up. You achieved nothing except basically death and destruction and despair, and you were responsible for, you can go around the table, you were responsible for 23 million people dying. You actually did a good job. You got rid of 60 million. You weren't too bad. You only did 15 million. And there's Napoleon. Now we've got to forgive him. He was French. Poor guy. But these people are all going to be alive. And here's the catch. I don't know if this is the good or the bad bit. We will be able to see all our ancestors. You'll be able to go back because they'll all be there, won't they? I know my dad's dad will be there. My dad's dad, I've got his Bible. He's got a little, one of these little tiny pocket Bibles. It's interesting the scriptures he's got marked up. It's all about the world tomorrow. All about the world tomorrow. Church of Scotland. Very interesting. But he'll be there. And he had, I think, 10 brothers, 7 of which were killed in the First World War. And so it goes on. You know, you can go back, and you can go back to the family, you can go back, and you go back, and you go back. And then perhaps sometimes you might wish you couldn't go back. You find out who some of our people were. But you'll be able to follow the trail all the way back to Adam. It's going to be a fascinating time. Absolutely fascinating. But we were just wondering how many sons of God there will have to be. You almost get the impression there's a one-to-one situation here, because these people will come out of all sorts of societies. The vast majority of people who've ever lived, I mean, we're fortunate. I was born in 1944. The war still had another 18 months. I mean, it didn't matter to me. I was kind of yay big. But I have never known war in my lifetime. Oh, I've been involved in them, taking photographs of people killing each other. That's great fun. But, I've not been subjected to war. Few of us have, if you're under 70, because we've had peace. We've had peace, haven't we, of a sort. You think of all the people who've died in the last war. First World War, I think I mentioned this during the week. You had that thing on the Somme, you blow the whistle and all the Brits would jump out the trench and run at the Germans, who'd mow them down with the machine gun, and then half an hour later, when they got the bodies back, and the Germans would get up and rush the British trenches, and they'd mow the Germans down, and this is how it went on until they wiped out 1 million men. And once they got to the 1 million men, they thought, I don't think this is a good idea. They were a bit slow back then, you see. 1 million. Like the First World War killed, I think it was 30 million, but then more died after the war with the flu epidemic. All those people are going to be resurrected. And what are they going to be resurrected into? They're going to be resurrected into Luke 23. Let's go to Luke 23. Luke 23 and verse 39. One of the mountains, remember Christ was crucified with a thief on each side of him. It makes you wonder why they did that to infer that he was of the same level. And interestingly, what would happen when you were crucified like that is the body would be just taken down and thrown into Gehenna, onto the rubbish dump. They weren't even buried. That's what they used to do. It was the final insult. That's why Joseph of Arimathea went and claimed Christ's body. Actually, he demanded it. He didn't claim it. Because he actually outranked Pilate. It would seem that he was a very high official in the Roman government. A very, very, very wealthy man. It still took guts to do what he did. But it was all part of prophecy. And it had to be fulfilled. He was the man to do the job at the time. But these malefactors were hanging. One of them railed and said, if you be Christ, save yourself and us. But the other answering rebuked him, saying, Do you not fear God, seeing that you are in the same condemnation? And if indeed, and we indeed justly, for we receive the due reward of our deeds. In other words, they'd obviously done something that deserved death under the law. But this man has done nothing amiss. That was a witness to the people standing around there who will be resurrected on this day, right? As will the Roman centurion who put that spear up him and killed him. And he said to Jesus, Lord, remember me when you come into your kingdom. Now that's interesting. He must have heard Christ preaching. Otherwise, how would he know this? He must have heard. I don't think there's very many people who wouldn't have heard. Can you imagine what would happen today? I'll use Mr. Bowles as an example here. It's nice to use somebody else. Let's just say Mr. Bowles was now given the hand, the job of healing people. All he had to do was touch somebody and they were totally healed. No matter what was wrong with them, they were totally healed. Okay? So he's going down the street and there's a guy falling over with a wooden leg and he reaches out to help him and the wooden leg falls off and the guy's leg grows back. What would happen? He bumped into a blind lady and just happened to touch her and her vision came back. You know, it wouldn't take very long for YouTube, Twitter, and all the other things to be like mad about this guy who's going around, and all he's got to do is touch you, and you're healed. Right? That's basically what was happening, though, wasn't it? Christ was preaching the kingdom of God, and he was healing all manner of diseases. He even raised the dead. Remember Lazarus? He even deliberately stayed away until he stunk. That's what Martha and Mary were saying to him. You know, well, why didn't you come? He's dead. Open the door. You can't. He's stinking. He's been in there several days. Christ deliberately stayed away so that they would get the point. He had total control even over death. Lazarus come forth and you get this vision of this body floating out because he couldn't have walked because he was all wrapped up in grave cloths. That was done in front of a whole raft of people. It wasn't done in the backwater. Everybody saw that. All those people will be resurrected on this day because very few of them believed. So the miracles have nothing to do with it. All that happened to Mr. Bowles, he'd be wrapped into every television program you can get. Where'd you get this from? Who were you? Yeah, he gives them a message and turns around to the people and says, well, actually, I'm a minister of Jesus Christ and I'm here to preach the coming kingdom of God. Very shortly, Christ is coming to take over this whole planet to rule. That'd be the end of Mr. Bowles. Go into the nut factory, yeah. They wouldn't accept it. Do you know why I can say that? Because they didn't accept Christ. He came with the same message. So all these people are all going to come up at the same time. What about all the estimated 100 million people in the Middle Ages who were slaughtered at the instruction of, not by, at the instruction of, the Roman Catholic Church. People who died in the most hideous, well, read Fox's Book of Martyrs if you don't want to sleep at night. I don't suggest you go much past chapter 1. They were horrendous. What they did to people was just vile. All those people will be resurrected. And the last thing they remember was the way they died. Yeah? On a fire, maybe. Nice lingering death, being toasted from the feet up. I don't think. Being impaled on a stake, being strangled. Being stretched until all the bones were ripped out of joint. And so on and so on and so forth. They'll all be resurrected on this day, along with the people who were turning the rack and doing all the nasty bits and pieces to them. So you can see what sort of time it's going to be. Suddenly you're awake. And if you're going to be in the same similar location or the same people around you when you died, what are they going to see? The people who were tormenting them? Are they going to feel they were in a battle? Or I don't know. No idea. Maybe they'll be in different groups, and there'll have to be somebody there to grab hold of them, because most of them died screaming, or they died, or they watched their loved ones dying off in a famine. It's going to be a very, very tough time for a few days, until they can settle down. It's a bit like the millennium. It's not going to happen quickly. Mr. Armstrong said 2 to 3 generations. Before we start getting it right. Jesus said to him, Truly I say to you, move the comma out and put it behind today. It says here, verily I say unto thee, comma, today shalt you be with me in paradise, indicates that the translators felt that as you die, you go to heaven. As we all know, that's a bit of a joke, because the Bible says quite clearly that you don't. So put the comma behind today. Verily, verily, I say to you, today, comma, you shall be with me in the Garden of Eden. That's what the word paradise means, literally. It means the Garden of Eden. And Mr. Bowles is mentioning parkland. Oh yes, there'll be oak trees and sycamore trees, but you get the impression that the most precious trees are the fruit trees. Why? Because we need food to live. If you're feeling off colour and you need a little bit of a break, then you eat fruit. You eat lots of fruit. It helps the system rebalance. Interesting in the millennium that the rivers are full of fish, the lakes, the ponds, full of fish. Fish will be a big part of the diet. Interesting, the disciples, several of them were fishermen. Paradise refers to the Garden of Eden. That's what the world is going to be like at the time of this resurrection. Transcript from a sermon, The Need for Spiritual Knowledge. Mr. Armstrong says, oh, why can't people understand the teaching of God, the wonderful revelation of God, and how merciful God is? Everyone, capital letters, bold, underlined, everyone who has ever lived is going to have their chance, but they're not getting it now. Their minds are closed, and the natural mind of man, even to this day, is hostile against God. Because in Romans 8, verse 7, it says, because the carnal mind, the natural mind without God's Spirit, is enmity, it's rebellious, it's got hatred towards God's way, and it's not subject to God's law, and neither it can be. So, in Revelation 20, if we go back to Revelation 20, hopefully you get your thumb there. Revelation 20. Satan is cast into the bottomless pit. Verse 3, and cast him, it says, Bob, verse 2, and he laid hold of the dragon, the old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years, and cast him into the bottomless pit, and shut him up, and set a seal on him, that he should deceive the nations no more. Note that, that's what Satan's main tool is. Deception. That's what I did when I asked the question, how many pairs of unclean animals did Moses take into the ark? I deceive people by focusing their minds somewhere else. Is that not what Satan does? He focuses it on somebody's mind, saying, your boss is a nitwit. You should be trying to undermine him, pull him down, get him out, and you can get his job. Isn't that what happens in business so many times? Or if you own the company, you look around for other companies and think, well, that guy's screwing up. I'll get in there. I'll take over his company. I'll buy him out. I'll destroy him first so I can buy the company for next to nothing. This is Satan's way, isn't it? It's rebellion. It's competition. It's greed. It's get all the time. He's never changed. And you know what? We'll see now. He's not going to change. Not at all. So Satan is bound. But he's got to be loosed for a little season. He's got to be loose for a little season. And it says in Revelation 20, verse 7, when the 1,000 years are expired, Satan shall be loosed out of his prison and shall go out to deceive the nations. He hasn't changed a bit, has he? Which are in the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, and gather them together to battle, the number of whom is the sand of the sea. And they went up on the breadth of the earth and compassed the camp of the saints and the beloved city, and fire came down from heaven and devoured them. Now, we just need to understand, I think we mentioned during the week about Ezekiel 37, 38, and 39. It's backwards. 39 is the invasion by Gog and Magog when they come down and Christ returns and does some, whether it's some kind of wave, energy, force, power, whatever. But those around Jerusalem literally end up instantly as skeletons. The flesh, everything just pours off them. And as you go on out, they're dropping dead by the tens of millions. In fact, around about 166 million or thereabouts. The other 33 million get to go home and tell the people what happened because they're the witnesses. But when you come to backwards, 238, you can read it in your own time, they come back again against unwalled cities. In the latter days, it says. In the latter days. At that time, it doesn't seem there's any cleanup required. The first time, the captives coming back have got to spend 7 months burying bodies. And then they've got to get some fit young men to go careering around the country looking for bits and pieces so they can bury all the bones. And all the debris will be around. And to a degree, the people will probably live off that. They might have to use the trucks to get the bodies up and dump them in that valley. Whatever. But this time, in this particular case, it says fire came down from God out of heaven and devoured them. So you get the impression at the end of the millennium, when Gog and Magog come down, that there is a total slaughter. They're not just killed, they are annihilated. Because they can't be allowed to destroy the earth, because the earth's already been made ready for this day. Mr. Armstrong just says, grasp this. This is actually the Incredible Human Potential, chapter 11, talking about this time. He says, grasp this. These people are at peace. They shall not be inoculated with the satanic nature we now call human nature. They shall have been living happily in perfect peace. As Satan once more broadcasts. Remember, these nations are human. Satan is invisible, but notice the change that comes over them as soon as Satan is loosed. Satan is loosed. There's a change. But at the end of the millennium, when Satan comes back, he doesn't attack the people of Israel directly. Why? Because we're there. Now, this is where the speculation comes in that people may well live the whole 1,000 years. Because the people who live during the millennium will have no experience of Satan. Once we get past the first 2-3 generations, who's going to worry about Satan? I mean, come on. You're living in a world probably being sent out into new countries and helping people to plant the trees that are grown in the nurseries. And we take the truth all around the world. We build up nations. We give to the nations. And in turn, they get the point because the Spirit's poured out on them. And the whole world is at peace, apparently. And the whole world's been transformed into parkland. God says himself, I will plant trees in the wilderness. I will plant trees in the desert. Why? Not for fun. Those trees change the climate. That's how God brings about the rain in due season. It's all part of an ecosystem. We learned about this network under the ground of fungi, that link all the trees together. And I've seen this in the forest, as a matter of fact. I've often wondered about it. You see one dead tree in the middle of everything. It's dying. It just dies off and it rots. The trees all around survive. Now, it would seem there is a mechanism there that is self-protection. The whole world is symbiotic. It's all interrelated. The bee comes and pollinates the fruit, the flower, to bring forth whatever fruit. We've got a lovely plum tree at the bottom of our garden. This year, there's no plums because the weather was absolutely crazy in the spring. And nothing got pollinated because the tree came out with the flowers, and then we got 10 days of frost, and all the flowers died. So there's nothing, there's no fruit. There's no fruit. But there's that relationship. We heard about the bird. One bird can eat up to 10,000 grubs feeding its little family. We had a blue tit in the house next to us, where they'd got a toilet overflow plant, they put a new one in and left the hole. The blue tits make a nest in there, a tiny little bird, a tiny little hole. How they get through there is a miracle, because it's only about 3/4 of an inch to an inch in diameter. But all day we watch them, in, out, the two of them. All day, they don't stop. They've probably got 4 to 5 little guys in there with their mouths open the whole time. Amazing. I've missed some of this out here. The bit I wanted to get to, which is very important, turn to Ezekiel 38. This is something that I'd like you to see, because it just shows you that the truth is all here. All you've got to know is you've got to have the key. You've got to have the key to finding out. Ezekiel 38, verse 9. This is when when Satan is loosed, right? It says, verse 9, you shall ascend and come like a storm. This is talking about Gog and Magog now. That you'll be a cloud to cover the land. There's so many of them, they come down, there's hordes of them. probably even more than came down the first time. And he says, cover the land, maybe even in the air, and all your bands and many people with you. Verse 10, get it. This is important, this verse. And thus says the Lord, it shall also come to pass at the same time shall these things come into your mind, that you shall think of evil thought. Where does the evil thought come from? Satan's back. He's just been loosed out of prison. He's been seething for almost 1,000 years. He's knowing he's coming out. He's knowing he's got one last shot at destroying God's people. His whole venom is turned into this event. Verse 11, I will go up to the land of unwalled villages. I will go to them that are at rest, that dwell in safety. Or they're dwelling without walls and having neither bars nor gates. How can you have bars nor gates when somebody can walk into your orchard and eat some of your apples? They're not allowed to come in with a basket and take a whole basket away. But this is how people will be. You want to look after people. Everybody will be looking out for somebody else. Because it's a give society. The gleaning bit, you know, you just cut your crop and leave the rest on the field. Because there are going to be poorer people. They can then come, they can get their fill. So they also are eating and be filled. It's giving, 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 giving. And Mr. Armstrong really said you can put the whole thing down to two words, give and get. God's way is give, Satan's way is get. In verse 16, and you shall come against my people Israel, God said, as a cloud to cover the land. You mean this is like one major league invasion. It shall be in the latter days, and I will bring you against my land, that the heathen may know me, when I shall be sanctified in thee, O God, before their eyes. This massive army, air force, whatever, is going to come screaming down there, incited by Satan. But this time, they are in verse 18. And it shall come to pass at the same time when God shall come against the land of Israel, says the eternal God, that my fury shall come up in my face. Now, we read earlier on in the week about my fury being poured out. Don't be around when that happens. Or be an observer is cool from a very safe distance. It's like lighting one of those big fireworks, yeah? It's just light blue taper and retire to a safe distance. But when Jesus Christ gets good and angry, that's a good policy. The only trouble is we might be involved actually in this. Because this army just seems to be disintegrated. They can't be allowed to destroy the land because the land's being made ready for the White Throne Judgment. So why aren't the people, most of the people, I would imagine, not affected? Well, we're going to tell them, aren't we? We're not just going to sit there and say, you know, somebody says, is there something about Satan getting in? No, I can't tell you. We're going to warn them. We're going to tell them straight. Now we're going to lose Satan. And this is what he's going to do. Be ready for it. And Satan is released. And immediately people start getting this competitive, argumentative, stressful sort of nature, which is satanic. And they'll suddenly think, I never felt like this before. You know, I've never had these thoughts in my mind before. And then they'll realize this power of this great being. And they will tell them, now what he's going to do, he's going to stir up these nations, he's going to bring them down, and you are going to see this huge invasion force coming. And if the people have lived for the 1,000 years, the ones that were there at the beginning will remember clearing up the mess, and they can spread the story around. Yeah, 7 months, 6 days a week, 900,000 bodies a day. That's what it works out at. 900,000 to be cleared away every day if you're going to clear them all up in seven months. Yeah, we were there. You can go there. There's the valley. There's a monument or whatever there. They're all under there. This army seems to be destroyed in its tracks. It's vaporized. Why? Because God wants to show. It says time and time again. He says, yeah, in 37. Well, let's read this. Just start from Ezekiel 37, verse 1, because this goes back in the prophecy, right? Ezekiel 37, verse 1. The hand of the Eternal was upon me and carried me out in the spirit of the Lord and set me down in the midst of a valley full of dry bones. So drop down to verse 11. And he said to me, son of man, these bones are the whole house of Israel. Behold, they say, our bones are dried, our hope is lost, and we are cut off. You know the rest of the story. Verse 13. Why is God doing it this way? Why is his plan this way? Why is it so complicated? Why do we need all these resurrections? Why do we need a millennium? Why do we need to lock up Satan? Why do we need to let him out again? Time and time again, you get this phrase in verse 13. And you will know that I am the eternal, your God. That's the key. That's the big lesson we've all got to get out of all these feast days and all our Bible study and all the sermons we hear and the articles we read. It's all focusing us on the fact that we are the children of God, and we've got to be, and we've got to understand that he is what he is, and we are going to be like him. Dumbfounding? Unbelievable? Dumbfounding, yes. Unbelievable, no. Unbelievable, no. We are going to be like him. As it says in John, they said, we will see him as he is. You go back in that prophecy, you want to take the time to read back in Ezekiel 37. It goes back into the first 14 verses are the White Throne Judgment period. About all these physical bodies being resurrected to physical life, to have their chance to live and to learn and to grow and to start thinking like God, to where eventually they can come into the God family. But if you go back to verse 15, it comes back even further in time. It's now coming back into the millennium. And he talks about taking two sticks, one for Judah and one for Israel, and joining them back together again. Because we've been apart, haven't we? We've been apart. Way over 2,000 years, we've been apart. But we won't be. We'll be back together again. In verse 22, and it says, I will make them one nation in the land upon the mountains of Israel, with one king shall be king to all of them, and they shall no more be two nations, neither shall they be divided into two kingdoms any more. And verse 24, My servant, shall be king over them. So in the millennium, David the king will be king over all of Israel. What happened back then at the time of Solomon, with Rehoboam and Jeroboam and the split and all that, that will be healed and brought back together. So Judah will be as one with Israel, right at the beginning of the millennium. And they will then know who we are. We know who they are, or we think we know who they are. I question whether some of them are really Jews, but that's another story. But there are Jews there. The house of Judah is there. They want to build a temple. They want to worship their God. And they're ready. They're ready. The minute they get the word, that altar will be up there, and those sacrifices will start. And it could happen overnight. It's that quick. But they'll be back to being one nation. And this is the exciting part. If you look at Satan, you know, why? I was talking last night about this. Why does God let Satan out at the end of the millennium? It's to show people what he's like. He has not changed. It's strife. It's war. After 1,000 years of peace, he can't come back and say, oh, okay. My way didn't work. You got it right. I'll knuckle under it. We'll go along with Christ, because obviously his ways work and mine don't. No, he doesn't. He immediately gets an army and wants to destroy it, doesn't he? So he's not changed. And how does he work? He goes out to deceive the nations. Deceive the nations. He hasn't changed. He hasn't changed one bit. So we come to this day in Revelation 20, verse 11. Revelation 20 and... verse 11. I saw a great white throne, and him that sat on it, and from whose face the earth and the heaven fled away, and there was found no place for them. And I saw the dead, small and great, stand before God, and the books were opened, and another book was opened, which is the book of life, and the dead were judged for those things which they were written in the books, according to their works. And that's when they will get the message. What you did was wrong. You are guilty of death. And Christ will tell them, I paid that penalty for you, but now you're starting again with a clean sheet. What a plan! How few people are privileged to understand this great plan, which culminates on this day. On Monday, we tried to put a cash value on a tree, didn't we? Would you like to put a cash value on the knowledge of God's plan for all of mankind? Christ did. Turn to Matthew 13. Matthew 13. Matthew 13 and verse 45. These lovely parables that Christ spoke so the whole world could understand, right? No, these are the parables he spoke so the church could understand, the people he'd chosen. Again, the kingdom of heaven is like unto a merchant man seeking goodly pearls, fabulously rich, wealthy pearls, you know, rich pearls, who, when he found one pearl of great price, went and sold all that he had and bought it. All. He took all of his fortune and he just put it all into buying this pearl. At baptism, that's what we should be doing after baptism. Because all that we had, everything prior to baptism, was garbage, wasn't it? It was this world. What we have now is this pearl of great price. So what I'd like to do is just close off with a quote, Mr. Armstrong. It's a sermon, The Trunk of the Tree, given in October 83. We need to keep these things basically in mind because they are the foundation. Isn't that the problem with the church today? Most of the church has unfortunately gone. They've erred. They have strayed from the foundation. That's where the problem is. And all the other things of how we must live as Christian lives fit within the framework of this general outline and foundation. It's all got to fit within this framework on the foundation. Mr. Armstrong told us that. Isn't it funny that when Mr. Bowles wrote that booklet on what is an apostle, is that not what's stressed? It's the foundation. That's the key to the whole thing. I can see that it's my job to give you the basic foundation primarily, and the other ministers, and he drops off, he says, in other words, I'm giving you the trunk of the tree, the roots of the trunk and the major branches, and the others fill in with the smaller branches, and it's smaller branches than that, and the little twigs, but they're all important. They're all part of the tree. We're back to trees again, aren't we? Sorry. But he says, but it's all part of the same wonderful purpose of God, and it's a wonderful purpose, and we're involved in it. We're key figures in it, as strange as that may seem. It's a wonderful thing that we have been called to such a high calling. It's clear beyond anything you can possibly imagine. So let's keep that in mind, because this is the culmination of God's plan for mankind today.